Arguably, vision's taken a little bit of a beating in the seminar series, or at least visualism, as the opposition to other senses. I'm happy that today we have some very distinguished discussions about visualism and its coming and going. Our second speaker, Marion Hirsch, is the William Peterfield Trent Professor of English and Comparative Literature. I'm relieved at getting through that. At Columbia University, also co-director of the Center for the Critical Analysis of Social Difference. She's a prolific author of numerous books and articles, recently one called Ghosts of Home, The Afterlife of Czernowitz in Jewish Memory, which he wrote with Leo Spitzer, and a forthcoming book of essays called The Generation of Post-Memory. My own favorite is an older book, Family Frames, Photography, Narrative, and Post-Memory. More important for our purposes, throughout her work, whether writing about families, 9/11, exile, or the Holocaust, Marion Hirsch has engaged with great seriousness and I think brilliant effect with issues of memory, identity, and visual representation. Today, she's going to talk about a different subject, but I think with some of the same concerns with You Don't See Me, the subject of class photos.
Thank you so much, Jim, for this lovely introduction. And thank you very much for the invitation, and Karen, for a wonderful paper. I think these are going to be very different approaches to photography and the unseen. And I'm really looking forward to the discussion. Can you all hear me? Yes. Thank you. Okay. Let me just say that this is... some of what you're hearing today is based on some thinking and writing that Leo Spitzer and I have begun to do about school pictures, and so some of these thoughts are co-authored. This is me when I was 10 years old, says Margie in the first frame of Marjan Satrapi's Persepolis, a memoir in graphic form. And we see a little girl simply drawn, wearing the veil and looking serious, if not glum. The present tense confirms that we're looking at the drawing of a fractured photograph through which the artist narrator introduces herself. The portrait of the 10-year-old Margie is merely a detail of a class photo shown in the next frame in which she is not visible, as she assumes a pose identical to that of the other four girls. You don't see me, on ne me voit pas. She tells us as she names the other four from left to right. All five wear the veil and all look distressed, although with a few lines, Satrapi is able to convey physiognomic differences and a range of facial expressions. Why use a class photo by way of a personal introduction? This is me. And why is Margie invisible within it? The opening frames of Persepolis tell us a great deal, I think, about this most unremarked genre of vernacular photography, which within the visual structure of the comics medium underscores the ideological transformation effected by the Islamist revolution that interrupted Margie's childhood. The rest of Persepolis plays out the uneasy and sometimes violent oscillation between a me that can be visually captured and monitored and the evasive, on ne me voit pas, you don't see me, an oscillation between the subject of authoritarianism and the rebellious I who's successfully able to hide in the gutter between the frames. Class photos, even under politically less authoritarian circumstances, dramatize precisely the individual child's struggle between, on the one hand, individuality and privacy, and ideological interpolation on the other. The extreme situation drawn by Satrapi merely accentuates some of the general features of this photographic genre. Loss, childhood vulnerability, the social integrationist effort of schooling, the process of creating group identities. But Margie's disappearance into the gutter of Satrapi's drawings and her You Don't See Me also, it seems to me, enables us to think about what can and cannot be seen in the photograph more generally. This afternoon, I would like to use school pictures to think about what, in a genre that has more and more become associated with hypervisibility and consequent knowability, nevertheless remains unseen. And so, just for an example, this is my first grade picture. You can try to find me. Although taken by commercial photographers with few, if any, artistic aspirations and little desire to deviate from formulaic representations, class pictures can nevertheless expose some fundamental characteristics of the photograph. And in fact, I would say that they might be a particularly good source for an analysis of the photograph, precisely because they've been so thoroughly ignored by critics. I'd like to highlight several photographic attributes that emerge particularly well from a study of class pictures. The relationship between photographer and photographed subject that they stage, their indexicality and iconicity, their temporalities and ideologies, their framings and reframings, the social and emotional lives and afterlives that they lead, their multiple, often contradictory meanings, and the overt and shadow archives that they draw on and create. And I'll come back to all this. These, I hope, can help us to think about the unseen in photography, and also, I hope, about the importance of what can indeed be seen in and through them, because, as it were, I would not like to lose sight of what can be seen in the photograph. I think that's become politically very important as well. But let me begin with Walter Benjamin, whom we've already invoked several times today. And by looking what Benjamin's writings on photographs, the photograph's ability to expose the invisible that is present inside the visible. Benjamin's concept of the optical unconscious, das optisch Unbewusste, is elaborated in his 1931 essay, A Little History of Photography, and in both versions of his 1936, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. In particular, he mentions those bodily movements that are too minute to be discerned by the human eye and too automatic to impinge on human consciousness that the camera makes visible. Edward Muybridge's series of still images of horses running, women walking, or men wrestling must have been in his mind. The camera is able to reveal these movements, enhancing our ability to see, and I quote, "Evidently, a different nature opens itself to the camera than opens to the naked eye, if only because an unconsciously penetrated space is substituted for a space consciously explored by man. Even if one has general knowledge of the way people walk, one knows nothing of a person's posture during a fractional second of a stride. Here, the camera intervenes with the resources of its lowerings and liftings, its interruptions and isolations, its extensions and accelerations, its enlargements and reductions." End of quote. Clearly, Benjamin means to focus on the minutest physiological processes, but his analogy for the workings of the camera is psychoanalysis, and the notion he invokes is the unconscious. Quote, "The camera introduces us to unconscious optics, as does psychoanalysis to unconscious impulses." So the camera for Benjamin is like psychoanalysis. There are optical processes and visual details that are undetectable to the naked eye, and they can be exposed by the mechanical processes of photography. The camera can reveal what we see without realizing that we do, just as psychoanalysis can uncover what we know without knowing that we do. What has been relegated to the unconscious? The camera can expose hidden dimensions of our actions and movements through its artificial techniques of making strange, its lowerings and liftings, its interruptions and isolations, its extensions and accelerations, its enlargements and reductions, to quote Benjamin again. In the same way that psychoanalysis can reveal unconscious content through the formal and precise techniques of the analytic encounter. So the optical unconscious, like the repressed psychological content of the unconscious, disturbs and disrupts our conscious acts of looking, opening up what Benjamin calls a different nature. Like physiological or psychic processes, looking is complex, multi-layered, contradictory, conflicted. Perhaps in establishing this analogy, Benjamin was thinking of the elaborate analogy Freud developed in his interpretation of dreams for the translation between the conscious and the unconscious mind. And I quote Freud, "All that can become the object of our inner perception is virtual, like the image that passes through the rays of the telescope. But those systems that are not in themselves psychic and that are not accessible to our psychic apprehension We are justified in imagining like the lenses of the telescope that project the image. By extension, the censoring mechanism between the two systems would correspond to the refraction during the passage into a new medium. And this is interesting in relation to the spirit becoming visible, right? And your title, Refracted Vision. What filters the passage between the unconscious, this is the end of the quote. What filters the passage between unconscious and consciousness functions like an optical instrument, a telescope, or maybe a camera. For Freud, that instrument, the camera, let's say, cannot actually make us see, but it can at least help us to sense the multiple dimensions of the seen and unseen that are refracted through its filters. For Benjamin, in contrast, photography's ability to show minute details invisible to the naked eye risk making it too transparent, too mimetic an art, producing what appears to be too straightforward or faithful a reproduction of the photographed. Together, increased mimetic illusion and mechanical reproduction risk robbing photographs of the aura that we've already discussed that characterizes the authentic work of art. The greater the technical advances, the closer the image is to the real, the further removed the photograph becomes from the erratic, and the more implicated in a realism that for Benjamin has dangerous ideological implications. So on the one hand then, Benjamin's unconscious optics resulting from technical advances offer ever greater mimetic and representational possibilities, but on the other hand, they make us conscious of the vast invisible dimensions behind and inside the transparently visible. Not just the unseen, but also all the different aspects of this sensible world that may be unavailable to sight. Thus, paradoxically, the camera actually accentuates the individual photograph's infidelity to a complicated and layered real, and unconscious optics end up calling attention precisely to what Benjamin most values and most fears will disappear, the inability to represent that remains at the core of our technologies of reproduction and representation. Now, if this seems convoluted, it really is. But I think that this argument gets at one of the basic tensions in photography, the tension between all that a photograph promises to reveal and the little it can actually show. And in doing so, it gets at the power of the photo to touch, affect, and frustrate its viewers precisely through its inability to find a proper balance between what it can and cannot make visible and comprehensible. Benjamin's oscillation continues, I think, to haunt our thinking about photography. And in speaking today about the unseen, I don't want to neglect, as I've already said, the evidentiary power that adheres to photography and that in recent years has returned with surprising force in political terms. The camera will become smaller and smaller, Benjamin writes, more and more prepared to grasp fleeting secret images whose shock will bring the whole mechanism of association to a complete halt. At this point, captions must begin to function. So for Benjamin, then, captions inscribe the image into a discursive framework, making it safer, tamer, less disturbing, bringing it into the realm of the conscious and the speakable. Class photographs, however, representing many different individual children and attempting to inscribe them into into a single frame and a recognizable ideology figured by the camera's single point perspective, highlight the difficulty of this discursive reduction. They foreground the contradictions and tensions that continue to define the photographic image, but they do so by taking us beyond a focus on the camera and the photographer who points it to other subjectivities, the photographed subject in front of the lens and viewers who look at the photos and who save, catalog, display, and circulate them. And here they touch us both through what we can see in them and through all that remains unseen. Class photographs share many of the same features. A group of students, third grade, standing or sitting on benches or by their desks or standing outdoors in rows near the school building, all face forward and look at the photographer and the camera setup that provide the single point perspective arranging the assemblage. The group is often focused around an authority figure who serves as a disciplining force, enjoining the children to assume postures and gazes that demonstrate their acquiescence to an imposed group identity. In this regard, of course, the larger national matrix in which a school is embedded plays a key ideological role. Schools are the accredited institutions that teach children how to read and write, and that provide them with elements of a national literary and scientific culture, and especially of its versions of history. They're also the sites that instruct students in rules of acceptable behavior and morality, tutor them in civic responsibility, and instill respect for authority and the established economic order. While aided in this task of ideological inculcation by other institutions, by the family, the law, the media, and the arts, schools are primary agencies in shaping and reinforcing values, outlooks, beliefs, and myths that constitute citizenship in a society where they are located. In this regard, class photos, like school report cards and diplomas, can be considered a form of certification available to all the persons depicted within them, a confirmation of grade level, of grade ascendancy, and of participation in a trajectory of socialization defining citizenship and national belonging. Each image, then, is both a form and an instrument, visual evidence of a commonality among the children in a class, of a standardization often reinforced by the mandated wearing of school uniforms, by dress and hair codes, and by other means of minimizing or erasing differences. Through the idiom of comics, Satrapi is able to emphasize how coercively schools impose uniformity and discourage, even punish, divergence from the norm. The ideological functions of the class photographs, mostly implicit in the image, tend to impede but not altogether eliminate the possibilities of subversion by individuals in the class. Subjects may try to fool around before or even while the photos are being taken, but the school images that tend to survive are for the most part the ones that record the most uniform, smiling or deadpan look on all the faces. School photographs thus do more than certify a step in the trajectory of ideological incorporation. They also instantiate the institutional process that interpolates the individual into a group identity. And as such, the instrument that creates them, the camera with which they are taken, both documents and embodies the process of interpolation and socialization that integrates children into the dominant worldview implied by the photograph's focalization. It instantiates the gaze that controls the visual field, and it's given to be seen, to use Kaja Silverman's term. And this is a school in French school in 1941, or a home for refugee Jewish children. Serge Klarfeld's father and sister are here. Serge Klarfeld became a famous Nazi hunter, as you probably know. And this, I will be talking more about images from these schools in a minute. Their conventionality would seem to make school photos largely unremarkable. And yet, they're pervasive in family albums. They're commonly this pervasiveness in family albums, their common display on memorial websites and at reunions, their frequent reproduction in communal histories and in memoirs, and their appeal to numerous artists who reframe them in new images and installations. This is an installation by Christian Boltanski. Belie the seeming flatness. Perhaps school photos are interesting precisely because, through the multiple looks that circulate within them and around them, they exceed the reach of the singular institutional gaze that would delimit their meanings and revelatory capacities. Because they depict individuals in group settings, school photos serve precisely as visible, incontrovertible evidence of belonging that can become powerful confirmation in shifting political circumstances in situations of war, persecution, or genocide. This is an image by Marcel Obrotsky, Buona Memoria, that crosses out all the his classmates who were disappeared during the dirty war in Argentina. So they become not only potent media for anyone wishing to memorialize and mourn a world of yesterday, but also effective mnemonic aids helping to identify particular living classmates, as well as to recall and to honor agemates who have disappeared or have been violently removed from our midst. As archival documents, they carry evidence of past existence and previous acceptance. They assert we were here, and we were here as part of this grouping. Thus, they can thus bring out less visible but no less powerful emotive as well as political dimensions that make them potent vehicles combating forgetting, the erasure of violence, and the exclusion and eradication of some members from the group or the destruction of the group itself. This is an image of children in hiding, Jewish refugee children photographed at a moment when French Vichy schools had expelled them and when their parents had already been deported, arrested, or been hidden in hiding in different locations. even as they tried to elude the lethal gaze that positioned them as undesirable, dispensable fodder for the Nazi killing machine, these children in a home in the village of Isieux near Lyon were extensively photographed, and one wonders why the teachers and neighbors who took the photos would have wanted to expose them to the visibility engendered by the camera gaze. I'm going to show a number of pictures from Isieux. The children's homes and schools set up by the OSCE organization that worked to rescue Jewish children in France throughout the years of the occupation, and ironically, to continue educating them in a French curriculum, were in fact easy targets of Nazi and Vichy government persecution. By 1943, the organization even considered shutting down its children's homes for fear of attracting attention to the children rather than hiding them. The tactic they chose instead, for the most part, was to place children into Christian families, smuggle them across borders, or disguise the children's homes that remained open as Christian and separate them from the official activities of the organization. This was the case for the house in Isieux, officially named the Settlement for Refugee Children from Hérault, a neighboring town. Except for one picture taken by a neighbor in 1944, the pictures that survived from Isieux, and there are quite a number, were taken by a non-Jewish assistant instructor, Paulette Payares, who had brought her camera to Isieux during the summer of 1943 when she worked there. What was her motive? Was she recording her summer job at the school? Did she want to document the life of these children who had been separated from their parents or orphaned? Did she simply want to practice her photographic skills? It was the remoteness of the village, the protection of the subprefecture of nearby Belley, and the hospitality of the local population that made the teachers at the children's home in Isieux believe in its relative safety, even when raids and arrests forced the shutdown of many similar institutions in the region. So the lethal raid engineered by Klaus Barbie on April 6, 1944, in which 44 children were seized and deported to Drancy and then to Auschwitz, came as a complete surprise. In effect, Paulette Payares' camera produced a rare record of most of the children who were picked up in the raid. In contrast, there are no remaining photos of the 4,000 children picked up in July 1942 and taken to the Vélodrome d'Hiver outside of Paris and deported, and very few pictures remaining of other such victims. So in photographing the children in the home in Isieux, Paulette Payares and the neighbor who photographed them in 44 might have been thinking of the genre of the class picture or the camp photograph. And through this genre, they themselves and some of the children who had left the home in the intervening months could become holders of a memory that was indeed supported by the photograph's indexicality. The radical contextual difference of these Isieux images is not visible in the most widely circulated of these photos, which conforms quite closely to the conventions of the genre. The children smile, they face forward, they look intently at someone standing to the left of the camera. The danger to which the children are subject, the efforts of the townspeople and international agencies hiding them, the worries they might have about their parents and their own future, all these remain outside of the frame of this image. In the picture itself, they seem happy, closely knit as a group, and the moment itself seems ordinary, normal. The conventionality of the image disguises and indeed renders invisible the extraordinary circumstance in which this picture and others from the same period are snapped. This particular image, and you recognize the cropped image of the larger one that I had shown you, was widely circulated in 1987 during the trial of Klaus Barbie. It was his deportation order of the children and the fact that one non-Jewish child was released during the raid that qualified Barbie for the charge of crimes against humanity and genocide, without which he could not have been brought to justice at such a temporal remove from the dates of his multiple crimes. But in order to function as an effective memorial and evidentiary medium of such a crime, the original image from Isieux had to be cropped, its message consolidated. In the cropped image, only four mostly older children and two teachers are visible. The cropping unifies a disparate and incongruous image, folding it into a genre of the class photo and its single point perspective. If we compare it to the full image, we see a multiplicity of looks, gestures, and affects that in turn point to other instances of the unseen. In addition, the larger image reveals the incongruity of this photograph. Facing into the sun, the children are squinting, many of them are in shadow. Clearly, this is not taken by a professional photographer, and clearly, this mixed assemblage is not one class or an integrated summer camp group. And of course, as you've already seen in some of the other pictures that I've shown you, all these your pictures share some of these characteristics: informal groupings, poor lighting, informal setup, the random snapshots of an amateur who is not in a position of authority over the children. The looks traversing the camera gaze can only begin to suggest differences among these children who are from different backgrounds, probably speak different languages, have different relationships to the dangers that surround them. For the children of Izyu, the frame in which they're united, like the home in which they're safe only for a very short while, increases their vulnerability to denunciation and deportation, and in fact, proved to be lethal. Like all photographs, school pictures have the capacity of recording and inscribing such contradictions, divergences that the conventionality and uniformity of poses, middle-distance camera angles, and institutional sanctions would seem to exclude. As the act of cropping the Izyu image shows, every group image, assembling a number of diverse individuals, inscribes a greater range of meanings than the photographer would have intended to record or the situation of the image would have accommodated. These invisible but detectable meanings and effects may be individual or collective, but in either case, they exceed the narrow institutional gaze of the image and the act of interpolation that school photos are intended to perform. So I would suggest that we could read class photos as a subset of a more encompassing genre of group portraits, paintings or photographs of guilds, army units, clubs, unions, youth groups, for example. And if we do so, we could speculate more generally on the unseen resonances that they might evoke. Doing this, we might see them in the terms introduced by the art historian Abi Warburg, who in his Mnemosyny Atlas mapped a large set of what he called pre-established expressive forms that carry and transmit affect across time, constituting a transgenerational memorial repertoire in visual form. If class photos fall into such a category of expressive forms, then their emotional life, to use art historian Jill Bennett's term, would be transmissible. And in fact, I argue that it is. By recalling the subordination of individuality to group membership and incorporation into a social and civic assemblage, they convey both the desire to belong to the group and the resistance against the overtly or indiscernibly coercive submergence of the individual in a class collective. This tension between individuality and trans-individual anonymity, between assimilation to the group on the one hand and subversion and resistance on the other, I think is characteristic of the emotional life of class photos. So we might wonder, and maybe you have already, about the uniform smiles that these your children are exhibiting. The ideologically unifying medium of the school picture must have elicited, or the camp picture, must have elicited, if not coerced, these expressions on the faces of these boys and girls who were being saved. But what, in such circumstances, does it mean to save a child? What is the relationship of the image to its own future? In the photographer Jeff Wall's terms, the temporality of the photograph is both liquid, immersed, as he says, in the incalculable, and dry, as a result of the optical photographic apparatus associated with modern vision and its evidentiary power. Connected to the complexities and vulnerabilities of childhood and youth, school pictures keep developing, as it were, activating and reactivating memory and affect in shifting present circumstances. Invisibly, images contain their own future, in which they will be looked at, reevaluated, in which their meanings will evolve and change, and in which they will have new roles to play in intimate and public settings. The children and young adults in these youth photo clearly did not live to look back at the image from the vantage point of adulthood. Their life was cut short. In the New York Times magazine cover reproduction in relation to an article about the Barbie trial prompted the photographer and artist Lori Novak to use it as the basis for her composite projection, Past Lives, an image that I've written about before but I keep returning to. Past Lives, the title signals retrospection and evolution, the inscription of this picture into a public memorial and historical context. Novak's projection and superimposition allows for some of the unseen aspects of the Izyu picture to be glimpsed, restoring to it some of the messiness and multivalence, some of the effective registers that had been cropped out of the image on the New York Times magazine. The technique of multiple projections that are then rephotographed proliferates the perspectives and temporalities of the photographic image, extending it in space and time, taking a measure of its afterlife. Marking the moment of the Barbie trial, but through a personal, effective and artistic act of engagement, Lori Novak projected the New York Times image onto the wall of a room, superimposing it onto two other images that I think you can detect as you look at it. That of herself as a small child held in her mother's arms, projected on the left wall, and of that of Ethel Rosenberg's face on the right. Novak's past lives connects the group image to two individual images, one of mother and child, and one of the mother and public figure who, like the children in the group picture, was killed by the state. Novak is an artist known for her work with family pictures. She has assembled thousands from numerous sources around the world in her digital archive, Collected Visions, and she has used a number of her own in installations and projections. In past lives, as in a number of her other works, she shows us the shadow archive that haunts the intimacy of the family picture. Institutional images and public stories of murder, deportation, and execution, as well as the fears and nightmares these engender, and from which the circle of family and the maternal embrace can protect neither children nor parents. With the corner wall and its straight lines that enclose the figures like a photographic frame, and the cropped frame in particular, and the children's faces that exceed the limits of these lines, past lives enacts the tensions and paradoxes inherent in the photograph. Gone is the freedom of the outdoor assemblage. These children are trapped in a room, enclosed in the nightmare of the little girl whose mother, like Ethel Rosenberg, cannot shield her from the vulnerability and danger faced by those other children. Novak's work clarifies the negotiation photography stages between knowing and seeing, removing all transparency from the documentary image. As we look at her past lives, we don't know what we're seeing, but we can sense danger, ghostliness, an uneasy mixture of smiles and terror on the photographed faces. When the Isieux image circulated during the Barbie trial and appeared on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, 43 years, and in many other newspapers, 43 years after the genocidal murder of its subject, it served as incontrovertible evidence of their past existence. It helped to indict Klaus Barbie for their murder, and it aided in their memorialization. But Novak's projection also shows us some of what remains unseen in the image itself, its complicated emotional life and afterlife in liquid time. The performative force of the Isieux picture, both in its documentary version and in Novak's projection, may well reframe our question about the seen and the unseen. School pictures are evidentiary archives of recognition, to be sure, but they're also archives of attachment to the past, to a former self, to a sense of belonging, and they're archives of resistance and detachment at the same time. They're both representational, official or semi-official records, and anti-representational, resonant documents that can transmit affect over space and time. In this sense, I would say they exceed the question of visibility and invisibility and the transaction between seeing and knowing that has been so fundamental to photography criticism and theory. So I would say, rather than asking what they can or cannot show, or what they can or cannot be seen, we might instead ask what they can and cannot do. Thank you.